This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on May 11th, 2011. And tonight's guest is Mark Rusinovich, who is the author of the book Zero Day, but he also happens to be a technical fellow at Microsoft. He has a PhD in computer engineering from Carnegie Mellon. You might know him also from being the author of popular sysinternals tools like AutoRuns, and we're happy to have Mark on the show tonight.
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be here.
So the book that just came out this year is called Zero Day. It features a lot of scenarios involving terrorists who work with computers instead of terrorists who work with explosives and things like that. So what got you to the point of writing this book?
So back in the early 2000s, you probably remember, and probably a lot of the people listening remember, the wave after wave of computer worms that were hitting the internet, Code Red and SQL Slammer. These worms were a lot of times just written by somebody in their parents' basement, just seeing what they could do by releasing a worm and seeing how far it could spread. And despite the fact that they really didn't have any specific goal in mind, they ended up causing a lot of havoc, incidentally. By slowing down the internet in one case, in SQL Slammer, it's actually slowed down the internet, crashed ATM machines in another case, brought down airline reservation systems. And that just started me thinking how easy it was for somebody to cause that kind of havoc without really trying to. What if you had a group of people that really were intent on causing some serious damage? And we also started to see this cat and mouse game with malware and the anti-malware community, or we'd been seeing it for a while, but things were escalating. We started to see rootkits and we also started to see this just amazing proliferation of malware with polymorphic viruses and massive variants of the same thing that were overloading the anti-malware community. And so I put all that together and thought, what if I was a really devious, evil person, what could I do? And I think with some modest level of sophistication, a lot of people could, if they set their minds to it, cause a serious amount of problems on the internet. The good thing is that most people don't have any motivation to do that. And most people today that do have some kind of motivation to leverage malware are after financial gain. But I thought an even worse kind of scenario, besides this, the financial problems that are kind of a burden that we're living with today in the cyber world, would be the terrorists that would just want to cause destruction, let some virus go, take advantage of the fact that the anti-malware community is overloaded, create massive variants, create the viruses in a way that nobody really knows what they're doing, the people that are creating it, and then let it loose. And I probably have to stop there before I reveal too much about the plot, but that's what got me down that path and into the plot of the book.
And it's interesting that you talk about motivation. It always kind of occurred to me back in those days when like SQL Slammer was around that this was just someone who was trying to see what they could do. And now when you read stories, there's obviously a network, a black market, whatever you want to call it, where people are financially incentivized to produce malware. Do you know when that sort of happened, or has that always been the case?
I think that there's always been some amount of financial malware, but so it was really around that same time that we started to see the explosion of it. I think there was a good book called the Zero Day Threat. There's been several books around the carding scene, which involves malware as well, and use of computers to harvest credit card numbers and skimmers that would pull credit cards off, credit card mag strips off people doing swipes. But that stuff it's been happening for quite some time, and it's just moved from more physical people dumpster diving for that stuff into magstripe skimmers, and then leveraging computers to fish people's financial information, log their keystrokes, set up botnets to do this kind of thing. And that evolution's been happening since probably around 2000. That's when we started to see a big uptick in that kind of activity, and it's just been growing ever since.
Did you do anything to, I mean, you've written books before, but they've always been about Windows internal. So did you have to do anything to switch your mindset to do fiction writing?
Yeah, actually, it was a pretty big mindset. Actually, it's a big change or a mind shift for me to get into writing at all, because I have various modes of operation. I have modes where speaking mode, writing modes, programming mode, and then this one was a fiction mode. And all of them are very different from my brain, and it's like I hear the gears grinding as I switch from one to the other, and it takes me a while to get back into the swing of the new thing that I'm starting. So fiction was even a bigger change than what I'd experienced before. And I read a lot of books about writing fiction. I took a few shots at practicing it, and then finally laid down an outline and then wrote a draft, and then have gone over that draft probably 24 times at various points in the last 6 years based on my own edit passes and suggestions from friends, suggestions from the editor, suggestions from my agent, and to get to the final product here.
What made you want to write fiction in the first place? I mean, is it just something that you've always wanted to do, or did something lead you down this path?
It's been something that I've always wanted to do. I was an avid reader growing up, like most people probably listening, read a lot of science fiction, read a lot of thrillers. There's a few books that, just like movies, stick in my mind. And one of them was The Andromeda Strain, which I read like in seventh grade, which was one of the first mainstream kind of thrillers that I'd read by Michael Crichton, and thought that that book was really cool because I felt like I was learning something while I was reading it. It was really technical, and I also was a fan of hardcore science fiction for the same reasons, and so I thought it'd be really cool to write a book that weaved technology into the story. It wasn't just a fluff book or a fan. I mean, I wasn't a big fan of fantasy because it wasn't really grounded in technology or science, and so I thought that it'd be fun to write a book like a Crichton or Clancy type of book. And when the issue with the kind of scenario that I've sketched out around the malware and used for terrorism is that it seems so obvious to me that if I was a bad guy, that this would be a great way to cause a lot of destruction with very relatively little effort, to be able to spread into places that would be extremely difficult to get to physically. It would be almost anonymous, and it'd be very hard to stop. And it didn't seem like to me that people were really considering this as a real threat. And so I thought, hey, great way to raise awareness of this would be to, and also have fun, would be tell a good story and satisfy a few things in one shot.
Yeah, you actually did a pretty good job terrifying me. I was traveling at the time that I read this book, and as I went through it, well, a couple things occurred to me. First of all, I thought, you know, I would have never picked up this book if I hadn't recognized your name, because most of these books that try to get technical end up with, you know, Will Smith uploads a virus to the alien mothership over a MacBook. But this one, you know, everything was very plausible. Everything was like, you know, that could really happen, and I just want to go home now.
Yeah. When I set out to write the book, I wanted to make it as realistic as I could. I wanted to stay true to cybersecurity, the anti-malware world, the malware world, teach people about what's really going on, not have those Will Smith moments in it. I did feel like I was stretching things a little bit in some of the scenarios where really the kind of attack that I foresee, the easiest, cheapest one, is more of a generic type of attack, which is just going after vanilla computer systems, vanilla Windows systems, vanilla Apple systems, if they decided to go that far. But some of the scenarios in the book are going after more infrastructure-oriented systems, which would require some more work, some more knowledge, and some more effort to get into. And so I that was where I was pulling a little bit of a Hollywood kind of taking liberties with that a little bit. Just
sure.
But it turns out that Stuxnet last year brought all of that a lot closer to being realistic and something that's not so out there as
and what was that again? Stuxnet?
Stuxnet virus. Virus that was discovered last summer. Actually, I was one of the first people to learn about it because somebody emailed it to me and said that they'd found a rootkit that was digitally signed with a certificate that was from a legitimate PC OEM manufacturer.
Uh-huh.
And so I took a look at it, and sure enough, it was signed by Micron Systems, a company that makes peripherals and components for PCs. I sent it to the Microsoft anti-malware research team, and then they started to investigate, talk to other anti-malware companies. And what unfolded over the next few days or next week or so was this virus was very sophisticated, had been spreading for quite a while, up to a year, and was really prevalent in Iran. And as the security researchers started to reverse engineer it, they found that it exploited four zero-day vulnerabilities in Windows to both spread and to elevate privilege once it got onto a machine, and that it had a component in it that was designed to infect and control Siemens SCADA systems, which are the computer systems that are generally used for controlling devices and process control and factory automation, infrastructure systems, generators. And when they reverse engineered that a little further, they found that it looked like it was targeted at specific Siemens controllers that were used in centrifuges, which just happened to be the same centrifuges used by the Iranian program for uranium enrichment in a couple of their nuclear plants, and that it looked like the virus, that component of the virus, would cause the centrifuges to spin faster than they were designed to and self-destruct, all the while sending back signals to whoever was operating them that everything was going fine. So this, obviously, an incredibly sophisticated piece of malware that seemed to have a very definite purpose. And the speculation is that Israel, with perhaps some involvement of the U.S., was behind the spread of that malware. But it ended up being successful. Iran announced that it had destroyed a few thousand of their centrifuges, and the international community believes that it, the analyst community believes that it set back Iran's nuclear program by about 2 years.
Wow.
You've done a very detailed series on your blog. We'll put links to that in the show notes. But that is just, from what I'd read and then going through your kind of technical analysis of it, it's, like you're saying, it's very sophisticated. And obviously, like what you were saying before is, you know, the early viruses, people just kind of create havoc by just doing silly things. And this is scary to see what somebody's done as, you know, quote unquote, like a professionally done virus. I mean, like the combination of 0 days and just all those steps. It's like, you know, I don't know. It's like James Bond, you know.
Exactly. I mean, it really shows with the right resources just how sophisticated you can be and how, I mean, the thing is, the thing was let loose and it ended up spreading. I mean, they didn't have control over how exactly it spread, but it ended up finding its way into these systems, controlling these centrifuges over a course of a few months, which is just amazing to think that it worked its way there almost on its own, like some kind of creature spreading and sniffing and happening to find it. But the fact that it went undetected for so long and yet had spread so far, and that it obviously people had discovered these zero-day vulnerabilities, programmed it into it, also figured out exactly how to basically create a rootkit for these SCADA systems on top of it. Incredible sophistication. But that kind of sophistication is actually pretty much for hire and not for that much money. There's so many sophisticated computer programmers, in, especially in Eastern Bloc and in Asia, that are selling their services to whoever will pay for them. And in most cases today, it's financial crime, but it could just as well be motivated by some other purpose, like this kind of thing or something else.
This reminded me a little bit, in a much smaller scale, but I believe it was Valve Software, where there was a kind of just a virus that was out there that was very targeted at stealing specific information off of the, you know, Valve computer games and kind of industrial espionage, but same sort of thing where it's just kind of let a virus float out there, but it's very targeted at a specific company.
There's been actually several examples of viruses that have been targeted at games and stealing people's logins for games. That is kind of similar, kind of. That's just one example of a motivation, not necessarily financial motivated, but some people targeting specific kinds of information.
So it's interesting that they would try to write a computer virus to do this kind of stuff, because it's kind of like the reason that we don't use anthrax in war and things like that, because it's kind of indiscriminate. And even if you are targeting, you know, specific chipsets or specific kind of controllers, in this case, it seems like it would be a little dangerous to let something like that loose kind of out there, because it could easily come back on you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's actually a good risk to highlight. There's a book that came out last year by Richard Clark, who's been in the terrorism and national security world for about 20 years. He served under the first Bush and Clinton and the second Bush. His book last year came, Cyber War, is one where he also rings the same kind of alarm bells that Zero Day does about how unprepared we are for this new threat landscape, how not just from terrorism, but for nation-state-sponsored cyber warfare, how we don't really have national policies on how to respond in the case that we think we're attacked, how to even detect that we're getting attacked, how to create good defenses and deterrence for attacks. That all of this stuff is really things that we've left unanswered, basically parts of our policy that aren't fleshed out. And his fear, just like mine, is that it's going to take some incident for us to wake up and actually go address these things. But he also points out in the book, one of the risks of letting malware like that loose as part of cyber warfare is that it can be indiscriminate, can get out of control and cause collateral damage that you don't mean to. I mean, the fact is, whoever let this go wasn't concerned with infecting computers that weren't the target at all on the way to get to the target, which is obviously a violation of people's personal property. And it's illegal to infect people's computers, and yet they were doing it in what they thought was the name of some greater good.
So in Zero Day, it looked, I mean, you didn't specifically call out Windows, but most of what you were talking about looked like Windows virus. And, you know, a lot of these things, a lot of controllers and those sort of things are run on Linux or other operating systems. We had a question from Twitter from MattD78, and he asked what you thought about Linux and if you've analyzed, you know, if you analyze source code from Linux for security and, you know, if you see kind of cross-platform threats and things like that.
So I haven't been looking at Linux. Obviously, I've been, for the last 4 years, been at Microsoft. So I've stayed away from analyzing Linux since then. Before that, I'd looked at Linux and actually wrote a sysinternals tool for Linux, a version of Philemon for Linux that was released for a while. But you point out that it seems like the book is focused on Windows. And the fact is that it really basically is focused on Windows just for the fact that you realistically have to say if somebody's going to target computer systems, and this is the same reason why there's a lot more malware aimed at Windows than anything else, is that it's 90% of the PCs out there are running Windows. And so if you're going to write a piece of malware, you're going to want the biggest return on your investment you can get. And that means writing a piece of malware that it doesn't infect 10% of computers or have that potential target, but 90% of computers, and that means you're going to write it for Windows. But that doesn't speak to anything about the relative security or vulnerability levels of different operating systems. I mean, Apple releases these monster packages of patches periodically, just like everybody else. And I think that this is recognized by the security research community, that Microsoft's really at the forefront of writing secure software with our secure development lifecycle, all the mitigations that we've put in place over time into the compilers and the operating system to as defense in depth and as anti-malware blocking. But it's a game that, you know, in security, there's no silver bullet. There's no 100%. So there's always work to be done and always ways for the bad guys can figure out. You leave one little tiny hole and they're going to have to go find it.
So most of the threats seem to be against PCs, whether it's, you know, Linux or Windows or whatnot. And I'm kind of wondering what you think about mobile devices, iPhones, iPads, and all those Android tablets becoming possible either vectors for infecting PCs or, you know, just infecting them themselves as people start to transition more of their personal data, their work data onto it. You know, whether it's industrial espionage against an executive who's using an iPad now instead of a netbook.
So I definitely think that as mobile devices continue to proliferate, that they become a much more attractive target to anybody after computing systems and capturing data off computing systems or using them as a platform to spread. One of the advantages that most of these mobile platforms have is they've started out more secure than PCs have become. I mean, still, most of the installed PCs out there in the world are Windows XP systems, which are missing some of the more advanced defense in depth measures and compiler enhancements in the code that they run that were introduced in Vista and Windows 7. And if you look at mobile devices, even Windows Phone or the iPhone or Android, they've got what's called Secure Launch, where they're programmed to only launch code that's been approved or that's got certain digital signatures, and they've got isolation between applications. So whereas the Windows world, you basically can run anything. It doesn't matter if it's digitally signed or not digitally signed, and there's no isolation between the applications that you run. They have full access to each other. So you get one malicious application, and it can infect every other application that you're running. So the mobile world is starting from a stronger position, but I do think that, you know, just like I was talking about, if there's going to be, if there's holes, people are going to find them. And as the platform gets more attractive, and more attractive means used by more people with data or information that you want to get at, the more effort people are going to put in to go finding those holes.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit behind on my blog reading. I'm just now reading through some of your last blog post on the Stuxnet virus, and it's amazing. And it's also amazing that you always seem to figure out so many things just using the sysinternals tools. Yeah. How did what was the genesis for sysinternals tools?
So the sysinternals tools actually started back in 1996. In early 96, I started to work on Windows 95 and Windows NT. Back then, I'd been working on Windows 3.1 for various academic stuff. But transitioning to Windows 95 and Windows NT, one of the first things that I wrote when I started using Windows NT, coming from using a lot of Unix systems when I was in grad school and undergrad, was something to swap the caps lock into control key. I mean, it just, once you're used to the control key being where the caps lock key is, it's just incredibly annoying, and I didn't want to have to retrain myself. So I was like, let me see if I can figure out a way to swap the caps lock into control key. And I knew about the I/O architecture in Windows, which allows you to create what's called a filter driver to intercept I/O commands aimed at one device driver and then be able to manipulate them. So I thought, hey, maybe I can intercept the commands aimed at the keyboard driver and then see the keystrokes coming back up into the system, look for a caps lock and swap it into control. And so that was the first tool that I wrote for Windows NT, and it's still on the site today, and I still run it on all my systems. It's called Control to Cap. And the second tool for Bryce Cogswell, who I'd met in grad school and we started working on the tools together, we wrote was for Windows NT, but sort of indirectly, and it was called NTFS DOS. And this was a DOS program that would let you mount NTFS volumes read-only. And that became really popular. People with NT systems that they couldn't boot anymore could at least salvage the data off those systems using NTFS DOS by booting the system off a floppy disk. And then, you know, I'd become familiar with the I/O architecture writing control to cap, and I thought, well, maybe I could write a filter driver that would watch file system activity. And so Bryce and I wrote FileMon as a third tool. And then I thought, it'd be cool if I could see activity to this thing called the registry in Windows NT. And doesn't go through those operations don't go through the I/O system, so I've got to figure out another way to do it. So I used something called system call hooking to watch registry activity, and Regmon was born. So those were the first few tools, and actually Regmon and FileMon were the most popular tools on the site for a long, long time. They eventually, Bryce and I in 2005, started rewriting completely new versions of those tools combined together in what's now called Process Monitor, which is a lot more powerful than those tools were. But that's kind of where it started. It's just writing tools, A, to learn about the system, B, learn about the system in the process of writing the tools, learn about the system by using the tools, and then share that with other people. And it turns out that those tools also, not just in terms of showing you what's going on in the system, ended up being useful diagnostic tools as well.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I just like the blog post too. If someone would email you a virus, I guess there's a couple different things you could do. You could try to open it up with a disassembler or WinDebug and spend, you know, hours and hours and hours trying to follow instructions around, or just launch these tools and actually watch how something interacts with the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's pretty cool that in about a half an hour of looking at the Stuxnet virus, without even reading the formal analysis that had been done by security researchers, I was able to get a sketch of what it does. And then I went back and looked at the formal anti-malware reports on what it did, and it matched up really nicely. And that was just, you know, I think the cool thing is that I didn't have to do any disassembly. I didn't have to step through code with a debugger. I simply was just watching what was going on inside with the sysinternals tools.
So one of the things I always liked about the sysinternal tools, or I guess, I forget when it was launched, a few years ago, was the live.sysinternals.com. Yeah. And that you can just browse to them and click on them and run them. And I always wondered, like, how does that actually work? You know, like, because, and like, number one, how does it work? And number two, why don't we see more tools and utilities like that out there? Because it's just so handy.
Yeah, that's actually a good question. And actually, it wasn't my idea. It was the, so when we, SysInternals has always been operated by me and Bryce, and then we've usually had a webmaster to help to post updates to the website for us. And when we were acquired by Microsoft, we continued to operate that way and had somebody that would run the SysInternals website for us and also the forums. His name is Curtis Metz, the first program manager for SysInternals. And one day he said, hey, you know, we could use this, you know, we're hosting on IIS, we could use WebDAV, which is the web, basically the web SMB support for exposing a file share off of an IIS server. And we could put the tools right on there, and then people could just surf to the share and download the tools or run them from there. And I thought that was a great idea, and thus was born SysInternals Live. So all it is a WebDAV share, which is standard IIS technology on the server side, and Windows knows how to mount SMB shares on the client side. And there you go, live.sysinternals.com.
That's great. Yeah, I love not having to, you know, like, obviously it's nice to have them just in case you're not on the internet or you've got to, you know, use them offline. But I've kind of stopped, you know, I used to always build a new machine, download them all, make sure I had them handy. And now it's like, I'll get them if I need them.
Yeah.
Do you, when you're looking at a virus, obviously you don't want to look at it on a live machine that you care about. Do you end up using a virtual machine for that? Or do you just have machines that are not, you know, it's okay if they get infected? Or?
No, I use a virtual machine because virtual machines are a lot more convenient for debugging viruses. You sit at, you know, virtually attach a kernel debugger to them, which is nice. Definitely in a virtual machine. Though the problem is that there's more and more viruses these days that are aware of that they're running in a virtual machine. So you got to figure out ways to defeat those detection mechanisms. And there's lots of ways that they can detect they're running in a virtual machine, unfortunately.
Yeah, I've read about those a while ago. There's a whole like red pill and blue pill and all the kind of hooking into timing, and it's pretty complex.
Yeah.
So another tool you have out there is the rootkit revealer.
Uh-huh. Rootkit revealer. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say you've discovered a few things with that tool.
Yeah, we were talking about it earlier, the Sony rootkit. The rootkit revealer, Bryce and I wrote in early 2005. The reason we rewrote it, we had developed over the years. I mentioned NTFS DOS. We developed this whole bunch of libraries and technology for understanding Windows data structures, Windows NT data structures, including the on-disk NTFS data structures. We'd also, as part of another product, figured out the on-disk registry data structures. And in early 2005 at RSA, a Microsoft employee named Mike Denseglio gave a talk about rootkits and how Microsoft was seeing rootkits starting to appear in malware. And rootkits had been something that the academic community had known about for some time. And rootkit-based malware had actually started on Unix systems, with the first rootkits being simply replacements for some of the core system utilities, like the LS utility, which is a directory listing utility, where the infected or replaced version would simply fail to show you certain files, and those files would be the malware files. And the term rootkit actually came from the fact that once the malware was on your computer, it used this kind of technology to maintain its root access or owning your box. When Mike gave that talk, he was sitting and talking with Bryce, and we spent lots of time getting together and talking about different aspects of computer technology. And so cybersecurity is one of the topics we talked about a lot. And we said, hey, you know what? We could actually write a tool that could detect rootkits because rootkits generally on Windows and were written to intercept API calls. A great example would be, you know, if you want to hide a file, you write a file system filter driver or write some system call hooker that would look for a command issued by an application to query the directory listing, would let that command go through. So the file system driver would populate the results with the list of files in the directory. Then the rootkit would get control of it, of that buffer, and remove the files that it wanted to hide, including itself, before it returned it. And then in Explorer, whatever tool you were looking at, you wouldn't see those files. Well, we figured if we did this, what I called a cross-view comparison, we might be able to detect that kind of rootkit. And the way that works is Rootkit Revealer scans the file system and registry data structures raw. So ideally beneath or circumventing the rootkit, going around it to see what's really there on the system. And then it performs API calls to do the same kind of query. So it'll do directory listings and registry key enumeration. And then it compares the two views it saw and reports anything that it saw in one view that it didn't see in another view. And those are potentially hidden files and hidden registry keys. So the way that the Sony rootkit, I stumbled across that, was we were periodically updating Rootkit Revealer. One of the reasons, by the way, that we had to update it is that the rootkit community would end up finding ways to defeat Rootkit Revealer. And some of the ways actually were pretty easy and pretty clever. There was a character back then named that called himself Holy Father that actually wrote a rootkit called Hacker Defender that he made available for free initially with source code. And then he also would sell versions of it that he wouldn't publish the source code. They were modified versions of it. And we found out from Microsoft, actually, that they discovered about a month after we released the first version of Rootkit Revealer that on a piece of malware was using a version of Hacker Defender that defeated Rootkit Revealer. And the way that it defeated it is this. Hacker Defender had a configuration file, an ini file, that would list the processes that it shouldn't hide things from. This is kind of like the root file list, which would include, you know, the malware. So you don't want to hide things from the malware. And what they did was just add Rootkit Revealer to that list. So Rootkit Revealer would go doing its scan, and the Hacker Defender would say, oh, this is a process that I shouldn't hide anything from. And so Rootkit Revealer would see the same thing on both scans and not show you any anomalies. So that caused me and Bryce to, yeah, so it's a really trivial way to defeat it. So me and Bryce had to figure out ways so that Hacker Defender couldn't identify Rootkit Revealer so easily. It was using just the file name. So what we did was we had Rootkit Revealer, when you run it, spin off a different version of itself with a different name. And this war of escalation went back and forth for a while until Hacker Defender retired for some reason. I don't think it was because of us, but he kind of gave up. But in any case, we were continuously updating Rootkit Revealer and tweaking it. And one day on my home systems, I was running scans, you know, just to make sure that it was working reliably. And I saw some anomalies on one of my systems, which was unexpected, and I started to dig into it and discovered that there was indeed a rootkit on that system, and traced it back using clues to a Sony CD that I'd bought and that had one of these custom music players in it, which a lot of CDs back then, music CDs back then had when DRM was really popular, and the music producers would release their own DRM-aware music players. You couldn't play the music with anything else but their players that would limit you to no more than 5 machines to play the music and things like that. And so then I wrote that blog post on Halloween that kind of launched fury across the internet again about this. Thus unfolded the saga. So Rootkit Revealer is what led to that.
You made quite a stir, didn't? Because that got into the mainstream press quite a bit, I believe, right?
Yeah, it did actually. I did interviews for Rolling Stone magazine and the Washington Post and a live radio interview with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and NPR. Actually, the NPR story was a pretty good one. The NPR called me up and I did an interview on the show. And then they also interviewed to a few other people. One of the people was a guy named Thomas Hess, who was the head of digital distribution at Sony at the time. And so they're asking him about, hey, you know, you got this rootkit on your CDs. What do you think of that? That doesn't seem like something you should be doing. And he said, well, you know, most people don't know what a rootkit is anyway, so I don't think it really matters. And that, so when that leaked out into, you know, when the blogosphere found out about that comment, they went ballistic on that one as well. And actually, a friend of mine, Miko Hipponen over at F-Secure, had T-shirts made up with that quotation on it just because it was just mind-boggling. It's like, just because people don't know about it or don't understand what a rootkit is, it makes it okay.
So I just have to say, you know, on behalf of millions of software developers everywhere, thank you so much for these tools. These internal tools have personally saved my butt so many times that I can't really imagine a world where they don't exist.
That's awesome. Yeah, that it's always really rewarding to hear people say that, and it makes working on the tools fun. It's fun because it's it's fun for me to write the tools, and then to know that just me spending time doing what's fun for me, and people find them so useful. You just mentioned Save My Butt, and that was funny because back Bryce and I, when we started SysInternals, we also started a commercial software company called WinTernals, which you mentioned, and the tools that we sold there were both more enterprise-focused versions in some cases, and completely different utilities in other cases than from what we gave away on the SysInternals website. But after a year or two in business, we would just get these emails sent to us that would be like, "Hey, I used ERD Commander or NTFS DOS Professional, and it saved my butt." And that was a common phrase that people would use. So our first advertisement was "Meet the two guys." I've got it on my wall in here. It's a picture of me and Bryce on a monitor, and the slogan is "Meet the two guys who are going to save your butt," and that was the first ad we published.
Nice. So now that you're in the belly of the beast and working for Microsoft, and I assume you have access to Windows source code, has that just made it a lot easier to do these kind of analyses? Can you do things more easily or go at a deeper level when you're analyzing things like malware and?
It's kind of funny because it is easier to get a big picture view of things. But before I joined Microsoft, the way that I would figure out the way things worked in Windows were two techniques. One was static analysis, but with a disassembler. So I used IDA Pro to disassemble whatever driver or the kernel that I was interested in analyzing, and the public symbols that Microsoft releases were very helpful for identifying functions and global variables that would serve as clues that were really useful in the reverse engineering process. But then I'd also use a disassembler like SoftICE or the Windows debugger, to step through the code. So I would analyze things statically, and I'd be like, get an idea or hypothesis about the way things worked. And then I would, in the live system, set breakpoints and look at the registers and confirm the hypothesis. And always I'd learn, hey, that I didn't get things quite right in the static analysis, or realize that certain code paths were always the ones that were taken on a live system. Well, when Dave and I Dave Solomon and I, my co-author in the Windows Internals book series, we were writing the books, we would sometimes have races because he had access to the source code and I didn't. So we'd be discussing something, and one of us would say, "I'm not sure really how this works. I think it has to do with this subsystem right here, this component, and this kind of API call." And one would say, "Hey, why don't we race to see who can figure out the answer first?" And so he would go to the source code, and I would go to my disassembly and debugger, and we'd race to see who could figure it out first. And I won just as many times as he did, with him having the source code. So, the combination of the static and dynamic reverse engineering actually could lead me to the answer faster than his static view of wading through text in the source code and source code files and jumping from one to the other.
So the majority of our listeners are .NET developers, and I wonder if you had any kind of common, I don't know, like anything you'd want to tell them as far as just writing more secure software?
Well, actually, .NET, just by the very fact that you've got a garbage collected type safe system, makes it a lot easier to write secure software than if you're doing native code. So right there, you're starting way ahead. I guess if you're staying purely in managed code, you've got to worry about logic issues with more typically when it comes to security, rather than things like buffer overflows or casting problems or memory leaks, mm-hmm. Double freeze, kind of memory problems that lead to exploits. So it's, a great example of a logic problem is a SQL injection. And that's more of the kind of problems that you got to worry about when you're working with .NET code, especially if you're working with ASP.NET code, obviously, or databases. Mm-hmm. Taking any place where you take input from users, you've got to treat that very carefully.
All right, I know we're getting pretty close to the end of your time slot, so I just wanted to give you a chance to tell us about anything you might have coming up or things you want to promote, any more books, presentations coming up.
Actually, we've been talking about SysInternals, and I'm excited to say that I've been working on a book with a friend of mine, Aaron Margosis, who works in Microsoft Consulting Services. And the book is Windows SysInternals Administrator's Reference. It's being published by Microsoft Press. It's going to be out in the middle of June, and it covers all 60 of the SysInternals tools, describing all their functionality and with tips on how to use them, and then also has a section of Case of the Unexplains, which are the Case of the Unexplains are my blog posts and presentations where I show the tools in action, kind of like the Stuxnet thing, with real-world cases that I've come up with myself or people have sent to me. So I think it's going to be a great book, and anybody that's using the tools or wants to get the most out of the tools or learn about tools that they might not be familiar with, that's a definite, I think, book to get when it comes out.
I had one more real quick question. A lot of time, like as you pointed out with Stuxnet and some of these others, there's always 0 days, there's always vulnerabilities that are out there. And so I'll argue with other software developers and they'll say, you know, there's no real point to running antivirus software. And I think that I've picked up pretty much, I mean, the tone usually in the book and what you've been saying is, you know, you should be running antivirus software and you should try and keep secure in other ways. What would you say? I mean, what's the point of running antivirus software if there are, you know, vulnerabilities out there that you're never going to be protected against everything?
Like I said before, there's no silver bullet when it comes to security, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't run around completely exposed to whatever things that are out there that are already known. Things that are exploiting vulnerabilities that have already been patched or pieces of malware that may be even trying to exploit new things, but that anti-malware is already somewhat familiar with and can end up blocking. So, or things that, you know, if you've got a system that's used by your kid, that's definitely a place where, or somebody that's not as computer savvy, that's definitely a place where you should be running anti-malware just to protect them from themselves, because one of the most common types of malware these days, and actually it's been common since back in 2004, 2005, in fact, I wrote a blog post about it, is the scareware, which you go to a website and you see a pop-up that looks like a official Windows type of pop-up. This is your computer's infected. Press here to do a scan, and you press the button and it's really launching a piece of software. And next thing you know, you've got a fake piece of anti-malware on your system that scares you into buying, giving your credit card number out and purchasing the quote-unquote real version of it, because it tells you that you're infected with 15 different viruses. And so that's just one example of the kind of tricks that these guys play on the unsuspecting. And it's amazing that even after all this time and after, like I said, these things have been around since 2005, if you want to see my blog post on it, it's called The Anti-Spyware Conspiracy, and that's from like 2006 or 2005. That it's been around that long, and yet so many people fall for that stuff still. I still find friends and family and friends of friends that have their systems infected, and it's because they fall for something like that. And anti-malware can do a good job of keeping people clean from that, protect them from that kind of stuff.
Thanks.
All right, Mark, I think you're out of time.
Any
last words?
No? No.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, let me just say, is there going to be a sequel to, or are there more books in your future?
I'm working on a sequel to Zero Day. It seems to.
Oh, cool.
I started working on the sequel a while ago, and I wanted to see, you know, if this had been unsuccessful, if people didn't like it, I would have just dropped it. But it looks like people like the book, so, and I've had a bunch of people actually say, hey, I want to see a sequel. And so I'm working on a sequel. It's probably going to be a year before it's ready, but it's in the works. And it's going to be based on another, it's going to have the same characters in it, the same two characters, Jeff and Daryl. And it's going to look at another very real type of scenario that we've got going on in cybersecurity that I think people find interesting and a lot of people aren't aware of.
Oh, cool.
So you'll have to read it to find out.
All right. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Okay, thanks.
And listeners, go out and buy Zero Day. That's Mark's book. It's getting rave reviews on Amazon. And tune in for the next episode.